Side 21, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 780. Eddie was shaking his head numbly before he realized this was another mistake. Henry's smile broadened.
Well, that's okay, he said. I don't mind taking you one by one. Come on down here, asshole.
Victor stood beside Henry. Patrick Hochstetter trailed behind them, smiling in a porky, vacant way Eddie was familiar with from school. Moose was still getting up.
Come on, asshole, Henry said. Let's talk about throwing rocks. Let's talk about that. You wanna?
Now that it was too late, Eddie decided it would be wise to go back into the store. Back in the store where there was a grown-up. But as he retreated, Henry darted forward and grabbed him. He pulled Eddie's arm, pulled hard, his smile turning into a snarl. Eddie's hand was ripped free of the screen door. He was pulled off the steps and would have crashed headlong into the gravel if Victor hadn't caught him roughly under the arms. Victor threw him. Eddie managed to keep on his feet, but only by whirling around twice. The four boys faced him now over a distance of about 10 feet, Henry slightly ahead of the others, smiling. His hair stood up at the back in a cowlick. Behind Henry and on his left was Patrick Hochstetter, a genuinely spooky kid. Eddie hadn't ever seen him with anyone else until today. He was just enough overweight so that his belly always hung slightly over his belt, which had a red rider buckle. His face was perfectly round and usually as pale as cream. Now he had a slight sunburn. It was heaviest on his nose, which was peeling, but it spread out toward either cheek like wings. In school, Patrick liked to kill flies with his green plastic school time ruler and put them in his pencil box. Sometimes he would show his fly collection to some new kid in the play yard at recess, his heavy lips smiling, his gray-green eyes sober and thoughtful. He never spoke when he exhibited his dead flies, no matter what the new kid might say to him. That expression was on his face now.
"How you doing, rock man?" Henry asked, advancing across the distance between them. "Got any rocks on you?"
"Leave me alone," Eddie said in a trembling voice.
"Leave me alone," Henry mimicked, waving his hands in mock terror.
Victor laughed.
"What are you going to do if I don't, rock man, huh?"
His hand flashed out incredibly fast and exploded against Eddie's cheek with a gunshot sound. Eddie's head rocked back. Tears began to pour from his left eye.
"My friends are inside," Eddie said.
"My friends are inside," Patrick Hochstetter squealed.
"Oh, oh, oh."
He began to circle to Eddie's right. Eddie started to turn in that direction. Henry's hand flashed out again, and this time his other cheek flamed.
"Don't cry," he thought. "That's what they want. But don't you do it, Eddie. Bill wouldn't do it. Bill wouldn't cry. And don't you cry either."
Victor stepped forward and gave Eddie a hard, open-handed push in the middle of his chest. Eddie stumbled half a step backward and then fell sprawling over Patrick, who had crouched directly behind his feet. He thudded to the gravel, scraping his arms. There was a woof as the wind rushed out of him. A moment later, Henry Bowers was on top of him, his knees pinning Eddie's arms, his butt on Eddie's stomach.
"Got any rocks, rock man?" Henry raved down at him, and Eddie was more frightened by the mad light in Henry's eyes than he was by the pain in his arms or by his inability to get his breath back.
Henry was nuts. Somewhere close by, Patrick tittered.
"You want to throw rocks, huh? I'll give you rocks. Here, here's some rocks."
Henry swept up a handful of gravel and slammed it down into Eddie's face. He rubbed the gravel into Eddie's skin, cutting his cheeks, his eyelids, his lips. Eddie opened his mouth and screamed.
"Want rocks? I'll give you rocks. Here's some rocks, rock man. You want rocks? Okay, okay, okay."
Gravel slammed into his open mouth, lacerating his gums, grinding against his teeth. He felt sparks fly against his fillings. He screamed again and spat gravel out.
"Want some more rocks? Okay. How about a few more? How about..."
"Stop that. Here, here. Stop that, you boy. Quit on him. Right now, you hear me? Quit on him." Through half-lidded, tear-blurred eyes, Eddie saw a big hand come down and grab Henry by the collar of his shirt and the right strap of his bibballs. The hand gave a yank, and Henry was pulled off. He landed in the gravel and got up. Eddie rose more slowly. He was trying to scramble to his feet, but his scrambler seemed temporarily broken. He gasped and spat chunks of bloody gravel out of his mouth. It was Mr. Guidreau, dressed in his long white apron, and he looked furious. There was no fear in his face, although Henry stood about 3 inches taller and probably outweighed him by 50 pounds. There was no fear in his face because he was the grown-up and Henry was the kid. Except this time, Eddie thought, that might not mean anything. Mr. Guidreau didn't understand.
He didn't understand that Henry was nuts.
You get out of here, Mr. Guidreau said, advancing on Henry until he stood toe-to-toe with the hulking, sullen-faced boy. You get out, and you don't want to come back either. I don't hold with bullying. I don't hold with four against one. What would your mothers think?
He swept the others with his hot, angry eyes. Moose and Victor dropped their gazes and examined their sneakers. Patrick only stared at and through Mr. Guidreau with that vacant gray-green look. Mr. Guidreau looked back at Henry and got just as far as, "You get on your bikes and..." when Henry gave him a good hard push. An expression of surprise that would have been comical in other circumstances spread across Mr. Guidreau's face as he flew backward, loose gravel spurting out from under his heels. He struck the steps leading up to the screen door and sat down hard.
"Why, you..."
he began. Henry's shadow fell on him.
"Get inside," he said.
"You..." Mr. Guidreau said, and this time he stopped on his own. Mr. Guidreau had finally seen it, Eddie realized, the light in Henry's eyes. He got up quickly, apron flapping. He went up the stairs as fast as he could, stumbling on the second one from the top and going briefly to one knee. He was up again at once, but that stumble, as brief as it had been, seemed to rob him of the rest of his grown-up authority. He spun around at the top and yelled, "I'm calling the cops." Henry made as if to lunge for him, and Mr. Guidreau flinched back.
That was the end, Eddie realized.
As incredible, as unthinkable as it seemed, there was no protection for him here. It was time to go. While Henry was standing at the bottom of the steps and glaring up at Mr. Guidreau, and while the others were staring, transfixed, and, except for Patrick Hochstetter, not a little horrified, by this sudden, successful defiance of adult authority, Eddie saw his chance. He whirled, took to his heels, and ran. He was halfway up the block before Henry turned, his eyes blazing.
"Get him!"
he bellowed. Asthma or no asthma, Eddie ran them a good race that day. There were spaces, some of them as long as 50 feet, when he couldn't remember if the soles of his PF Flyers had touched the sidewalk or not. For a few moments, he even entertained the giddy notion that he might be able to outrun them. Then, just before he reached Kansas Street and what might have been safety, a little kid on a trike suddenly pedaled out of a driveway and right into Eddie's path. Eddie tried to swerve, but running full out as he had been, he might have done better to jump over the kid. The kid's name, in fact, was Richard Cohen, and he would grow up, marry, and father a son named Frederick Cohen, who would be drowned in a toilet and then be partially eaten by a thing that rose up from the toilet like black smoke and then took an unthinkable shape. Or at least to try. One of Eddie's feet caught on the trike's back deck, where an adventurous little shit might stand and push the trike along like a scooter. Richard Cohen, whose unborn son would be murdered by it 27 years later, barely rocked on his trike. Eddie, however, went flying. He struck the sidewalk on his shoulder, rebounded, came down again, and skidded 10 feet, erasing the skin from his elbows and knees. He was trying to get up when Henry Bowers hit him like a shell from a bazooka and knocked him flat. Eddie's nose connected briskly with the concrete. Blood flew. Henry did a quick side roll like a paratrooper and was up again. He grabbed Eddie by the nape of the neck and by his right wrist. His breath, snorting through his swelled and splinted nose, was warm and moist.
"Want rocks, Rockman? Sure, shit."
He jerked Eddie's wrist halfway up his back.
Eddie yelled, "Rocks for the Rockman, right, Rockman?"
He jerked Eddie's wrist up even higher. Eddie screamed. Behind him, dimly, he could hear the others approaching and the little kid on the trike starting to bawl.
"Join the club, kid," he thought,
and in spite of the pain, in spite of the tears and the fear, he brayed a huge donkey-like hee-haw of laughter.
"You think this is funny?"
Henry asked, sounding suddenly astounded rather than furious.
"You think this is funny?"
And did Henry also sound scared?
Years later, Eddie would think, yes, scared. He sounded scared.
Eddie twisted his wrist in Henry's grip. He was slick with sweat, and he almost got away. Perhaps that was why Henry shoved Eddie's wrist up harder this time than before. Eddie heard a crack in his arm like the sound of winter wood giving under an accumulated plate of ice. The pain that rolled out of his fractured arm was gray and huge. He shrieked, but the sound seemed distant. The color was washing out of the world, and when Henry let go of him and pushed, he seemed to float toward the sidewalk. It took a long time to get down to that old sidewalk. He had a good look at every single crack in it as he glided down. He had a chance to admire the way the July sun glinted off the flecks of mica in that old sidewalk. He had a chance to note the remains of a very old hopscotch grid that had been done in pink chalk on that old sidewalk. Then, for just a moment, it swam and looked like something else. It looked like a turtle. He might have fainted then, but he struck on his newly broken arm, and this fresh pain was sharp, bright, hot, terrible. He felt the splintered ends of the green stick fracture grind together. He bit his tongue, bringing fresh blood. He rolled over on his back and saw Henry, Victor, Moose, and Patrick standing over him. They looked impossibly tall, impossibly high up, like pallbearers peering into a grave.
"You like that, Rock Man?"
Henry asked, his voice drifting down over a distance, floating through clouds of pain.
"You like that action, Rock Man? You like that Jabba Nabba?"
Patrick Hockstetter giggled.
"Your father's crazy,"
Eddie heard himself say,
"and so are you."
Henry's grin faded so fast it might have been slapped off his face. He drew his foot back to kick, and then a siren rose in the still hot afternoon. Henry paused. Victor and Moose looked around uneasily.
"Henry, I think we'd better get out of here," Moose said.
"I know damn well I'm getting out of here," Victor said.
How far away their voices seemed, like the clown's balloons. They seemed to float. Victor took off toward the library, cutting into McCarran Park to get off the street. Henry hesitated a moment longer, perhaps hoping the cop car was on some other business and he could continue with his own. But the siren rose again, closer.
"You got lucky, fuckface," he said.
He and Moose took off after Victor. Patrick Hockstetter waited for a moment.
"Here's a little something extra for you,"
he whispered in his low, husky voice. He inhaled and spat a large green lunger into Eddie's upturned, sweating, bloody face.
Splat! "Don't eat it all at once if you don't want,"
Patrick said, smiling his liverish, unsettling smile.
"Save some for later if you want."
Then he turned slowly and was also gone. Eddie tried to wipe the lunger off with his good arm, but even that little movement made the pain flare again.
"Now, when you started off for the drugstore, you never thought you'd end up on the Costello Avenue sidewalk with a busted arm and Patrick Hockstetter's snot running down your face, did you? You never even got to drink your Pepsi. Life's full of surprises, isn't it?"
Incredibly, he laughed again. It was a weak sound, and it hurt his broken arm to laugh, but it felt good. And there was something else. No asthma. His breathing was okay, at least for now. A good thing, too. He never would have been able to get to his aspirator. Never in 1,000 years. The siren was very close now, whooping and whooping. Eddie closed his eyes and saw red under his eyelids. Then the red turned black as a shadow fell over him. It was the little kid with the trike.
"You okay?"
the little kid asked.
"Do I look okay?"
Eddie asked.
"No, you look terrible,"
the little kid said, and pedaled off singing The Farmer in the Dell. Eddie began to giggle. Here was the cop car. He could hear the squeal of its brakes. He found himself hoping vaguely that Mr. Nell would be in it, even though he knew Mr. Nell was a foot patrolman.
"Why in the name of God are you giggling?"
He didn't know, any more than he knew why he should feel, in spite of the pain, such intense relief. Was it maybe just because he was still alive that the worst he had suffered was a broken arm, and there were still some pieces to pick up? He settled for that. But years later, sitting in the dairy library with a glass of gin and prune juice in front of him and his aspirator near at hand, he told the others he thought it was something more than that. He had been old enough to feel that something more, but not to understand or define it.
"I think it was the first real pain I ever felt in my life,"
he would tell the others.
"It wasn't what I thought it would be at all. It didn't put an end to me as a person. I think it gave me a basis for comparison, finding out you could still exist inside the pain, in spite of the pain."
Eddie turned his head weakly to the right and saw large black Firestone tires, blinding chrome hubcaps, and pulsing blue lights. He heard Mr. Nell's voice then, thickly Irish, impossibly Irish, more like Richie's Irish cop voice than Mr. Nell's real voice. But perhaps that was the distance.
"Holy Jesus, it's the Casbrack Bay."
At this point, Eddie floated away. 4. And, with one exception, stayed away for quite a while. There was a brief period of consciousness in the ambulance. He saw Mr. Nell sitting across from him, tipping a drink from his little brown bottle and reading a paperback called I, the Jury. The girl on the cover had the biggest bosoms Eddie had ever seen. His eyes shifted past Mr. Nell to the driver up front. The driver peered around at Eddie with a big leering grin, his skin livid with grease paint and talcum powder, his eyes shiny as new quarters. It was Pennywise.
"Mr. Nell,"
Eddie husked.
Mr. Nell looked up and smiled.
How are you feeling, me bye? Driver, the driver.
Yes, we'll be there in a jig, Mr. Nell said, and handed him the little brown bottle.
Suck some of this, it'll make you feel better.
Eddie drank what tasted like liquid fire. He coughed, hurting his arm. He looked toward the front and saw the driver again. Just some guy with a crew cut, no clown.
He drifted off again. Much later, there was the emergency room and a nurse wiping blood and dirt and snot and gravel off his face with a cold cloth. It stung, but it felt wonderful at the same time. He heard his mother bugling and clarioning outside, and he tried to tell the nurse not to let her in, but no words would come out, no matter how hard he tried.
If he's dying, I want to know,
his mother was bellowing. You hear me? It's my right to know, and it's my right to see him. I can sue you, you know. I know lawyers, plenty of lawyers. Some of my best friends are lawyers.
Don't try to talk, the nurse said to Eddie. She was young, and he could feel her bosoms pressing against his arm. For a moment, he had this crazy idea that the nurse was Beverly Marsh, and then he drifted away again. When he came back, his mother was in the room, talking to Dr. Handor at a mile-a-minute clip. Sonia Kasprak was a huge woman. Her legs encased in support hose were trunk-like, but weirdly smooth. Her face was pale now, except for hectic, flaring blots of rouge.
Ma, Eddie managed. All right, I'm all right.
You're not, Mrs. Kasprak moaned. She wrung her hands. Eddie heard her knuckles crack and grind. He began to feel his breath shorten up as he looked at her, seeing what a state she was in, how this latest escapade of his had hurt her. He wanted to tell her to take it easy or she'd have a heart attack, but he couldn't. His throat was too dry.
You're not all right. You've had a serious accident, a very serious accident. But you will be all right. I promise you that, Eddie. You will be all right, even if we need to bring in every specialist in the book. Oh, Eddie, Eddie, your poor arm.
She burst into honking sobs. Eddie saw that the nurse who had washed his face was looking at her without much sympathy. All through this aria, Dr. Handor had been stuttering, Sonia, please, Sonia, Sonia. He was a skinny, limp-looking man with a little mustache that hadn't grown very well and which, in addition, had been clipped unevenly, so as longer on the left side than on the right. He looked nervous. Eddie remembered what Mr. Keene had told him that morning and felt a certain sorrow for Dr. Handor. At last, gathering himself, Russ Handor managed to say, If you can't control yourself, you'll have to leave, Sonia. She whirled on him and he drew back.
I'll do no such thing. Don't you even suggest it. This is my son lying here in agony. My son lying here on his bed of pain.
Eddie astounded them all by finding his voice.
I want you to leave, Ma. If they're going to do something that'll make me yell, and I think they are, you'll feel better if you go.
She turned to him, astonished and hurt. At the sight of the hurt on her face, he felt his chest begin to tighten down inexorably.
I certainly will not, she cried. What an awful thing to say, Eddie. You're delirious. You don't understand what you're saying. That's the only explanation.
I don't know what the explanation is, and I don't care, the nurse said. All I know is that we're standing here doing nothing while we should be setting your son's arm.
Are you suggesting? Sonia began, her voice rising toward the high, bugling note it took on when she was most upset.
Please, Sonia, Dr. Handor said. Let's not have an argument here. Let's help Eddie. Sonia stood back, but her glowering eyes, the eyes of a mother bear whose cub has been threatened, promised the nurse that there would be trouble later, possibly even a suit. Then her eyes misted, extinguishing the glower, or at least hiding it. She took Eddie's good hand and squeezed it so painfully that he winced.
It's bad, but you'll be well again soon, she said. Well again soon, I promise you that.
Sure, Ma, Eddie wheezed. Could I have my aspirator?
Of course, she said. Sonia Kasprak looked at the nurse triumphantly, as if vindicated of some ridiculous criminal charge.
My son has asthma, she said. It's quite serious, but he copes with it beautifully.
Good, the nurse said flatly. His ma held the aspirator for him so he could inhale. A moment later, Dr. Handor was feeling Eddie's broken arm. He was as gentle as possible, but the pain was still enormous. Eddie felt like screaming and gritted his teeth against it. He was afraid if he screamed, his mother would scream too. Sweat stood out on his forehead in large, clear drops.
You're hurting him, Mrs. Kasprak said. I know you are. There's no need of that. Stop it. There's no need for you to hurt him. He's very delicate. He can't stand that sort of pain.
Eddie saw the nurse lock her furious eyes with Dr. Handor's tired, worried ones.
He saw the wordless conversation that passed between them.
Send that woman out of here, Doctor.
And in the drop of his eyes,
I can't. I don't dare.
There was great clarity inside the pain. Although, in truth, this was not a clarity that Eddie would want to experience often. The price was too high. And in that unspoken conversation, Eddie accepted everything Mr. Keene had told him. His hydrox aspirator was filled with nothing more than flavored water. The asthma wasn't in his throat or his chest or his lungs, but in his head. Somehow or other, he was going to have to deal with that truth. He looked at his mother, seeing her clear in his pain. Each flower on her Lane Bryant dress, the sweat stains under her arms where the pads she wore had soaked through, the scuff marks on her shoes. He saw how small her eyes were in their pockets of flesh, and now a terrible thought came to him. Those eyes were almost predatory, like the eyes of the leper that had crawled out of the basement at 29 Diebold Street.
Here I come, that's all right. It won't do you any good to run, Eddie.
Dr. Handor put his hands gently around Eddie's broken arm and squeezed. The pain exploded. Eddie drifted away. 5. They gave him some liquid to drink, and Dr. Handor set the fracture. He heard Dr. Handor telling his ma that it was a greenstick fracture, no more serious than any childhood break. It's the sort of break kids get falling out of trees, he said, and Eddie heard his ma respond furiously, Eddie doesn't climb trees. Now I want the truth. How bad is he? Then the nurse was giving him a pill. He felt her bosoms against his shoulder again and was grateful for their comforting pressure. Even through the haze he could see that the nurse was angry, and he thought he said, She's not the leper. Please don't think that. She's only eating me because she loves me. But perhaps nothing came out because the nurse's angry face didn't change. He had a faint recollection of being pushed up a corridor in a wheelchair and his mother's voice somewhere behind, fading,
What do you mean, visiting hours? Don't talk to me about visiting hours. That's my son.
Fading. He was glad she was fading, glad he was fading. The pain was gone and the clarity was gone with it. He didn't want to think. He wanted to drift. He was aware that his right arm felt very heavy. He wondered if they had put it in a cast yet. He couldn't seem to see if they had or not. He was vaguely aware of radios playing from rooms, of patients who looked like ghosts in their hospital johnnies walking up and down the wide halls, and that it was hot, so very hot. When he was wheeled into his room, he could see the sun going down in an angry orange boil of blood and thought incoherently,
like a great big clown button.
Come on, Eddie, you can walk, a voice was saying, and he found that he could. He was slid between crisp, cool sheets. The voice told him that he would have some pain in the night, but not to ring for a painkiller unless it got very bad. Eddie asked if he could have a drink of water. The water came with a straw that had an accordion middle so you could bend it. It was cool and good. He drank it all. There was pain in the night, a good deal of it. He lay awake in bed, holding the call button in his left hand, but not pressing it. A thunderstorm was going on outside, and when the lightning flashed blue-white, he turned his head away from the windows, afraid he might see a monstrous grinning face etched across the sky in that electric fire. At last he slept again, and in his sleep he had a dream. In it he saw Bill, Ben, Richie, Stan, Mike, and Bev, his friends, arriving at the hospital on their bikes. Bill was riding Richie double on Silver. He was surprised to see that Beverly was wearing a dress. It was a lovely green, the color of the Caribbean in a National Geographic plate. He couldn't remember if he had ever seen her in a dress before. All he remembered were jeans and pedal pushers and what the girls called school sets. Skirts and blouses. The blouses usually white with round collars, the skirts usually brown and pleated and hemmed at mid-shin so that the scabs on their knees didn't show. In the dream, he saw them coming in for the 2 p.m. visiting hours, and his mother, who had been waiting patiently since 11, shouting so loudly at them that everyone turned to look at her.
If you think you're going in there, you've got another think coming,
Eddie's mother shouted. And now the clown, who had been sitting here in the waiting room all along, but way back in one corner, with a copy of Look magazine held up in front of his face until now, jumped up and mimed applause, patting his white-gloved hands together rapidly. He capered and danced, now turning a cartwheel, now executing a neat back-over flip, as Mrs. Kasprak ranted at Eddie's fellow losers, and as they shrank, one by one, behind Bill, who only stood there, pale but outwardly calm, his hands stuffed deep into the pockets of his jeans. Maybe so no one, including Bill himself, would be able to see if they were shaking or not. No one saw the clown except Eddie. Although a baby who had been sleeping peacefully in his mother's arms awoke and began to cry lustily.
"You've done enough damage,"
Eddie's ma shouted.
"I know who those boys were. They've been in trouble at school. They've even been in trouble with the police. And just because those boys have something against you is no reason for them to have something against him. I told him so, and he agrees with me. He wants me to tell you to go away. He's done with you. He never wants to see any of you again. He doesn't want your so-called friendship anymore, any of you. I knew it would lead to trouble, and look at this. My Eddie in the hospital, a boy as delicate as he is."
The clown capered and jumped and did splits and stood on one hand. Its smile was real enough now, and in his dream Eddie realized that this was, of course, what the clown wanted, a nice big wedge to drive among them, splitting them apart and destroying any chance of concerted action. In a kind of filthy ecstasy, the clown did a double barrel roll and burlesqued kissing his mother's cheek.
Those boys who did it,
Bill began.
"Don't you speak back to me," Mrs. Kasprak shrieked. "Don't you dare speak back to me. He's done with you, I say. Done."
Then an intern came running into the waiting room and told Eddie's ma she would have to be quiet or leave the hospital. The clown started to fade, started to wash out. And as it did, it began to change. Eddie saw the leper, the mummy, the bird. He saw the werewolf and the vampire whose teeth were Gillette blue blades set at crazy angles like mirrors in a carnival mirror maze. He saw Frankenstein, the creature, and something fleshy and shell-like that opened and closed like a mouth. He saw a dozen other terrible things, 100. But just before the clown washed out completely, he saw the most terrible thing of all. His ma's face.
"No," he tried to scream. "No, no, not her, not my ma."
But no one looked around, no one heard. And in the dream's fading moments, he realized with a cold and wormy horror that they couldn't hear him. He was dead. It had killed him, and he was dead. He was a ghost. 6. Sonia Kasprak's sour-sweet triumph at sending Eddie's so-called friends away evaporated almost as soon as she stepped into Eddie's private room the next afternoon on the 21st of July. She could not tell exactly why the feeling of triumph should fade like that, or why it should be displaced by an unfocused fear. It was something in her son's pale face, which was not blurred with pain or anxiety, but instead bore an expression she could not remember ever having seen there before. It was sharp somehow, sharp and alert and set. The confrontation between Eddie's friends and Eddie's ma had not occurred in the waiting room, as in Eddie's dream. She had known they would be coming. Eddie's friends, who were probably teaching him to smoke cigarettes in spite of his asthma. His friends, who had such an unhealthy hold over him that they were all he talked about when he came home for the evening. His friends who got his arm broken. She had told all this to Mrs. Van Pratt next door. "The time has come," Mrs. Kasprak had said grimly, "to slap a few cards down on the table." Mrs. Van Pratt, who had horrible skin problems and who could almost always be counted upon to agree eagerly, almost pathetically, with everything Sonia Kasprak said, in this case had the temerity to disagree.
"I should think you'd be glad he's made some friends," Mrs. Van Pratt said as they hung out their washes in the early morning cool before work.
This had been during the first week of July.
"And he's safer if he's with other children, Mrs. Kasprak, don't you think so? With all that's going on in this town, and all the poor children that have been murdered?"
Mrs. Kasprak's only reply had been an angry sniff. In fact, she couldn't just then think of an adequate verbal response, although she thought of dozens, some of them extremely cutting, later on. And when Mrs. Van Pratt called her that evening, sounding rather anxious, to ask if Mrs. Kasprak would be going to the Beano down at St. Mary's with her like usual, Mrs. Kasprak had replied coldly that she believed she would just stay home that evening and put her feet up instead. Well, she hoped Mrs. Van Pratt was satisfied now. She hoped Mrs. Van Pratt saw now that the only danger abroad in Derry this summer wasn't the sex maniac killing children and babies. Here was her son, lying on his bed of pain in Derry Home Hospital. He might never be able to use his good right arm again. She had heard of such things, or, God forbid, loose splinters from the break might work through his bloodstream to his heart and puncture it and kill him. Oh, of course, God would never allow that to happen, but she had heard of it happening, so that meant God could allow such a thing to happen, in certain cases. So she lingered on the home hospital's long and shady front porch, knowing they would show up, coldly determined to put paid to this so-called friendship, this camaraderie that ended in broken arms and beds of pain, once and for all. Eventually they came, as she had known they would, and to her horror she saw that one of them was a nigger. Not that she had anything against niggers. She thought they had every right to ride where they wanted to on the buses down south and eat at white lunch counters and should not be made to sit in nigger heaven at the movies unless they bothered white women, people. But she also believed firmly in what she called the bird theory. Black birds flew with other black birds, not with the robins. Grackles roosted with grackles. They did not mix in with the bluebirds or the nightingales. To each his own was her motto, and seeing Mike Hanlon pedal up with the others just as if he belonged there caused her resolution, like her anger and her dismay, to grow apace. She thought reproachfully, as if Eddie were here and could listen to her, "You never told me that one of your friends was a nigger." Well, she thought, 20 minutes later, stepping into the hospital room where her son lay with his arm in a huge cast that was strapped to his chest, it hurt her heart just to look at it. She had sent them packing in jig time. No pun intended. None of them, except for the Denbro boy, the one who had such a horrible stutter, had had the nerve to so much as speak back to her. The girl, whoever she was, had flashed a pair of decidedly slutty jade's eyes at Sonya, from Lower Main Street or someplace even worse, had been Sonya Kasprak's opinion, but she had wisely kept her mouth shut. If she had dared so much as to let out a peep, Sonya would have given her a piece of her mind, would have told her what sort of girls ran with the boys. There were names for girls like that, and she would not have her son associated now or ever with the girls who bore them. The others had done no more than look down at their shuffling feet. That was about what she had expected. When she was done saying what she had to say, they had gotten on their bikes and ridden away. The Denbro boy had the Tozier boy riding double behind him on a huge, unsafe-looking bike, and with an interior shudder, Mrs. Kasprak had wondered how many times her Eddie had ridden on that dangerous bike, risking his arms and his legs and his neck and his life. "I did this for you, Eddie," she thought as she walked into the hospital with her head firmly up. "I know you may feel a bit disappointed at first. That's natural enough. But parents know better than their children. The reason God made parents in the first place was to guide, instruct, and protect." After his initial disappointment, he would understand. And if she felt a certain relief now, it was, of course, on Eddie's behalf and not on her own. Relief was only to be expected when you had saved your son from bad companions. Except that her sense of relief was marred by fresh unease now, looking into Eddie's face. He was not asleep as she had thought he would be. Instead of a drugged doze from which she would wake disoriented, dim-witted, and psychologically vulnerable, there was this sharp, watchful look, so different from Eddie's usual soft, tentative glance. Like Ben Hanscom, although Sonya did not know this, Eddie was the sort of boy who would look quickly into a face as if to test the emotional weather brewing there, and glance just as quickly away. But he was looking at her steadily now. "Perhaps it's the medication," she thought. "Of course, that's it. I'll have to consult with Dr. Handor about his medication." And she was the one who felt a need to glance aside. "He looks like he's been waiting for me," she thought. And it was a thought that should have made her happy. A boy waiting for his mother must surely be one of God's most favored creations. "You sent my friends away." The words came out flatly, with no doubt or question in them. She flinched almost guiltily. And certainly the first thought to flash through her mind was a guilty one. How does he know that? He can't know that. And she was immediately furious with herself, and him, for feeling that way. So she smiled at him. "How are we feeling today, Eddie?" That was the right response. Someone, some foolish candy striper, or perhaps even that incompetent and antagonistic nurse from the day before, had been carrying tales. Someone. "How are we feeling?" she asked again, when he didn't respond. She thought he hadn't heard her. She'd never read in any of her medical literature of a broken bone affecting the sense of hearing, but she supposed it was possible. Anything was possible. Eddie still didn't respond. She came farther into the room, hating the tentative, almost timid feeling inside her, distrusting it because she had never felt tentative or timid around Eddie before.
She felt anger as well, although that was still nascent.
What right did he have to make her feel that way, after all she had done for him, after all she had sacrificed for him?
"I've talked to Dr. Handor, and he assures me that you're going to be perfectly all right," Sonia said briskly, sitting down in the straight-backed wooden chair by the bed. "Of course, if there's the slightest problem, we'll go to see a specialist in Portland. In Boston, if that's what it takes."
She smiled, as if conferring a great favor. Eddie did not smile back, and still he did not reply.
"Eddie, are you hearing me?"
"You sent my friends away," he repeated.
"Yes,"
she said, dropping the pretense, and said no more. Two could play at that game. She simply looked back at him. But a strange thing happened. A terrible thing, really. Eddie's eyes seemed to grow somehow. The flecks of gray in them seemed actually to be moving, like racing storm clouds. She became aware suddenly that he was not in a snit, or having a poopy, or any of those things. He was furious with her, and Sonia was suddenly scared, because something more than her son seemed to be in this room. She dropped her eyes and fumbled her purse open. She began searching for a Kleenex.
"Yes, I sent them away," she said,
and found that her voice was strong enough and steady enough, as long as she wasn't looking at him.
"You've been seriously injured, Eddie. You don't need any visitors right now except from your own ma, and you don't need visitors like that ever. If it hadn't been for them, you'd be home watching the TV right now, or building on your soapbox racer in the garage."
It was Eddie's dream to build a soapbox racer and to take it to Bangor. If he won there, he would be awarded an all-expenses-paid trip to Akron, Ohio for the National Soapbox Derby. Sonia was perfectly willing to allow him this dream, as long as it seemed to her that completion of the racer, which was made out of orange crates and the wheels from a choo-choo flyer wagon, was just that, a dream. She certainly had no intention of letting Eddie risk his life in such a dangerous contraption, not in Derry, not in Bangor, and certainly not in Akron, which, Eddie had informed her, would mean riding in an airplane as well as making a suicidal run down a steep hill in a wheeled orange crate with no brakes. But, as her own mother had often said, what a person didn't know couldn't hurt him. Her mother had also been fond of saying, "Tell the truth and shame the devil." But when it came to the recollection of aphorisms, Sonia, like most people, could be remarkably selective.
"My friends didn't break my arm," Eddie said in that same flat voice. "I told Dr. Handor last night, and I told Mr. Nell when he came in this morning. Henry Bowers broke my arm. Some other kids were with him, but Henry did it. If I'd been with my friends, it never would have happened. It happened because I was alone."
This made Sonia think of Mrs. Van Pret's comment about how it was safer to have friends, and that brought the rage back like a tiger. She snapped her head up.
"That doesn't matter, and you know it. What do you think, Eddie, that your ma fell off a hay truck yesterday? Is that what you think? I know well enough why the Bowers boy broke your arm. That Patty cop was at our house, too. That big boy broke your arm because you and your friends crossed him somehow. Now, do you think that would have happened if you'd listened to me and stayed away from them in the first place?"
"No. I think that something even worse might have happened," Eddie said.
"Eddie, you don't mean that."
"I mean it,"
he said, and she felt that power coming off him, coming out of him in waves.
"Bill and the rest of my friends will be back, Ma. That's something I know. And when they come, you're not going to stop them. You're not going to say a word to them. They're my friends, and you're not going to steal my friends just because you're scared of being alone."
She stared at him, flabbergasted and terrified. Tears filled her eyes and spilled down her cheeks, wetting the powder there.
"This is how you talk to your mother now, I guess," she said through her sobs. "Maybe this is the way your friends talk to their folks. I guess you learned it from them."
She felt safer in her tears. Usually when she cried, Eddie cried too. A low weapon, some might say, but were there really any low weapons when it came to protecting her son? She thought not. She looked up, the tears streaming from her eyes, feeling both unutterably sad, bereft, betrayed, and sure. Eddie would not be able to stand against such a flood of tears and sorrow. That cold, sharp look would leave his face. Perhaps he would begin to gasp and wheeze a little bit, and that would be a sign, as it was always a sign, that the fight was over and that she had won another victory.
For him, of course. Always for him.
She was so shocked to see that same expression on his face. It had, if anything, deepened, that her voice caught in mid-sob. There was sorrow under his expression, but even that was frightening. It struck her in some way as an adult sorrow, and thinking of Eddie as adult in any way always caused a panicky little bird to flutter inside her mind. This was how she felt on the infrequent occasions when she wondered what would happen to her if Eddie didn't want to go to Derry Business College or the University of Maine in Orono or Husson in Bangor so he could come home every day after his classes were done. What would happen if he met a girl, fell in love, wanted to get married? Where's the place for me in any of that? The panicky bird voice would cry when these strange, almost nightmarish thoughts came. Where would my place be in a life like that? I love you, Eddie. I love you. I take care of you, and I love you. You don't know how to cook or change your sheets or wash your underwear. Why should you? I know those things for you. I know because I love you. He said it himself now. I love you, Ma, but I love my friends, too. I think you're making yourself cry. Eddie, you hurt me so much, she whispered, and fresh tears doubled his pale face, trebled it. If her tears a few moments ago had been calculated, these were not. In her own peculiar way, she was tough. She had seen her husband into his grave without cracking up. She had gotten a job in a depressed job market where it wasn't easy to get a job. She had raised her son, and when it had been necessary, she had fought for him. These were the first totally unaffected and uncalculated tears she had wept in years, perhaps since Eddie had gotten the bronchitis when he was 5 and she had been so sure he would die as he lay there in his bed of pain, glowing bright with fever, whooping and coughing and gasping for breath. She wept now because of that terribly adult, somehow alien expression on his face. She was afraid for him, but she was also, in some way, afraid of him, afraid of that aura that seemed to surround him, which seemed to demand something of her. "Don't make me have to choose between you and my friends, Ma," Eddie said. His voice was uneven, strained, but still under control, because that's not fair. "They're bad friends, Eddie," she cried in a near frenzy. "I know that. I feel that with all my heart. They'll bring you nothing but pain and grief." And the most horrible thing of all was that she did sense that. Some part of her had intuited it in the eyes of the Denbro boy, who had stood before her with his hands in his pockets, his red hair flaming in the summer sun. His eyes had been so grave, so strange and distant, like Eddie's eyes now. And hadn't that same aura been around him as was around Eddie now? The same, but even stronger? She thought yes. "Ma," she stood up so suddenly she almost knocked the straight-backed chair over. "I'll come back this evening," she said. "It's the shock, the accident, the pain, those things that make you talk this way. I know it. You... She groped and found her original text in the flying confusion of her mind. "You've had a bad accident, but you're going to be just fine. And you'll see I'm right, Eddie. They're bad friends. Not our sort, not for you. You think it over and ask yourself if your ma ever told you wrong before. You think about it and... I'm running," she thought with a sick and hurtful dismay. "I'm running away from my own son. Oh, God, please don't let this be. Ma." For a moment she almost fled anyway, scared of him now. Oh, yes, he was more than Eddie. She sensed the others in him, his friends, and something else. Something that was beyond even them. And she was afraid it might flash out at her. It was as if he were in the grip of something, some dreadful fever, as he had been in the grip of the bronchitis that time when he was 5, when he had almost died. She paused, her hand on the doorknob, not wanting to hear what he might say, and when he said it, it was so unexpected that for a moment she didn't really understand it. When comprehension crashed down, it came like a loose load of cement, and for a moment she thought she would faint. Eddie said, "Mr. Keene said my asthma medicine is just water." "What? What?" She turned, blazing eyes on him. "Just water, with some stuff added to make it taste like medicine. He said it was a placebo." "That's a lie. That is nothing but a solid lie. Why would Mr. Keene want to tell you a lie like that? Well, there are other drugstores in Derry, I guess. I've had time to think about it," Eddie said softly and implacably, his eyes never leaving hers. "And I think he's telling the truth." "Eddie, I tell you, he's not." The panic was back, fluttering. "What I think," Eddie said, "is that it must be the truth, or there would be some kind of warning on the bottle, like if you take too much it will kill you, or at least make you sick. Even..." "Eddie, I don't want to hear this," she cried, and clapped her hands to her ears. You're just not yourself, and that's all that it is. Even if it's something you can just go in and buy without a prescription, they put special instructions on it, he went on, not raising his voice. His gray eyes lay on hers, and she couldn't seem to drop her gaze or even move it. Even if it's just Vic's cough syrup or your Geritol. He paused for a moment. Her hands dropped from her ears. It seemed too much work to hold them up. They seemed very heavy.
And it's like... You must have known that too, Ma.
Eddie, she nearly wailed it. Because, he went on, as if she had not spoken at all. He was frowning now, concentrating on the problem.
Because your folks are supposed to know about medicines. Why, I use that aspirator 5, sometimes 6 times a day. And you wouldn't let me do that if you thought it could, like, hurt me. Because it's your job to protect me. I know it is, because that's what you always say.
So, did you know, Ma?
Did you know it was just water?
She said nothing. Her lips were trembling. It felt as if her whole face was trembling. She was no longer crying. She felt too scared to cry.
Because if you did, Eddie said, still frowning, if you did know, I'd want to know why. I can figure some things out, but not why my Ma would want me to think water was medicine, or that I had asthma here, he pointed to his chest, when Mr. Keene says I only have it up here, and he pointed to his head.
She thought she would explain everything then. She would explain it quietly and logically. How she had thought he was going to die when he was 5, and how that would have driven her crazy after losing Frank only 2 years before. How she came to understand that you can only protect your child through watchfulness and love. That you must tend a child as you tended a garden, fertilizing, weeding, and yes, occasionally pruning and thinning, as much as that hurt. She would tell him that sometimes it was better for a child, particularly a delicate child like Eddie, to think he was sick than to really get sick. And she would finish by talking to him about the deadly foolishness of doctors and the wonderful power of love. She would tell him that she knew he had asthma, and it didn't matter what the doctors thought or what they gave him for it. She would tell him you could make medicine with more than a malicious meddling druggist's mortar and pestle.
Eddie, she would say, it's medicine because your mother's love makes it medicine. And in just that way, for as long as you want me and let me, I can do that. This is a power that God gives to loving, caring mothers. Please, Eddie, please, my heart's own love, you must believe me.
But in the end, she said nothing. Her fright was too great.
But maybe we don't even have to talk about it, Eddie went on. Mr. Keene might have been joking with me. Sometimes grown-ups, you know, they like to play jokes on kids. Because kids believe almost anything. It's mean to do that to kids, but sometimes grown-ups do it.
Yes, Sonia Kasprak said eagerly. They like to joke, and sometimes they're stupid, mean, and...
So I'll kind of keep an eye out for Bill and the rest of my friends, Eddie said, and keep right on using my asthma medicine. That's probably best, don't you think?
She realized only now, when it was too late, how neatly, how cruelly, she had been trapped. What he was doing was almost blackmail, but what choice did she have? She wanted to ask him how he could be so calculating, so manipulative. She opened her mouth to ask, and then closed it again. It was too likely that, in his present mood, he might answer. But she knew one thing, yes, one thing for sure. She would never, never, never set foot into Mr. Nosey Parker Keene's drugstore again in her life. His voice, oddly shy now, interrupted her thoughts.
Ma?
She looked up and saw it was Eddie again, just Eddie, and she went to him gladly.
Can I have a hug, Ma?
She hugged him, but carefully, so as not to hurt his broken arm or dislodge any loose bone fragments so they could run an evil race around his bloodstream and then lodge in his heart. What mother would kill her son with love? And Eddie hugged her back. 7. As far as Eddie was concerned, his Ma left just in time. During the horrible confrontation with her, he had felt his breath piling up and up and up in his lungs and throat, still and tideless, stale and brackish, threatening to poison him. He held on until the door had snicked shut behind her, and then he began to gasp and wheeze. The sour air working in his tight throat jabbed up and down like a warm poker. He grabbed for his aspirator, hurting his arm but not caring. He triggered a long blast down his throat. He breathed deep of the camphor taste, thinking,
it doesn't matter if it's a placebo. Words don't matter if a thing works.
He lay back against his pillows, eyes closed, breathing freely for the first time since she had come in. He was scared, plenty scared. The things he had said to her, the way he had acted, it had been him, and yet it hadn't been him at all. There had been something working in him, working through him, some force. And his mother had felt it too. He had seen it in her eyes and in her trembling lips. He had no sense that this power was an evil one, but its enormous strength was frightening. It was like getting on an amusement park ride that was really dangerous and realizing you couldn't get off until it was over, come what might. No turning around, Eddie thought, feeling the hot, itchy weight of the cast that encased his broken arm. No one goes home until we get to the end. But God, I'm so scared, so scared. And he knew that the truest reason for demanding she not cut him off from his friends was something he could never have told her. I can't face this alone. He cried a little then, and then drifted off into a restless sleep. He dreamed of a darkness in which machinery, pumping machinery, ran on and on. 8. It was threatening showers again that evening when Bill and the rest of the losers returned to the hospital. Eddie was not surprised to see them come filing in. He had known they would be back. It had been hot all day. It was generally agreed later that that third week of July was the hottest of an exceptionally hot summer, and the thunderheads began to build up around 4 in the afternoon, purple, black, and colossal, pregnant with rain, loaded with lightnings. People went about their errands quickly and a little uneasily, with one eye always cocked at the sky. Most agreed it would rain good and hard by dinner time, washing some of the thick humidity out of the air. Derry's parks and playgrounds, underpopulated all summer, were totally deserted that evening by 6. The rain had still not fallen, and the swings hung moveless and shadeless in a light that was a queer flat yellow. Thunder rumbled thickly. That, a barking dog, and the low mutter of traffic on outer Main Street were the only sounds that drifted in through Eddie's window until the losers came. Bill was first, followed by Richie. Beverly and Stan followed them, then Mike. Ben came last. He looked excruciatingly uncomfortable in a white turtleneck sweater. They came to his bed, solemn. Not even Richie was smiling. Their faces, Eddie thought, fascinated. Jeezum Crow, their faces. He was seeing in them what his mother had seen in him that afternoon, that odd combination of power and helplessness. The yellow storm light lay on their skins, making their faces seem ghost-like, distant, shadowy. We're passing over, Eddie thought, passing over into something new. We're on the border. But what's on the other side? Where are we going? Where? Hello, Eddie, Bill said. How you did a-doin'? Okay, Big Bill, Eddie said and tried to smile. Had a day yesterday, I guess, Mike said. Thunder rumbled behind his voice. Neither the overhead light nor the bedside lamp was on in Eddie's room, and all of them seemed to fade in and out of that bruised light. Eddie thought of that light all over Derry right now, lying long and still across McCarran Park, falling through the holes in the roof of the Kissing Bridge in smudged lackadaisical rays, making the Kanduskeag look like smoky glass as it cut its broad, shallow path through the barrens. He thought of Seesaw standing at dead angles behind Derry Elementary as the thunderheads piled up and up. He thought of this thundery yellow light and the stillness, as if the whole town had fallen asleep. Or died. Yes, he said, it was a big day. My folks are going out to a movie the night after the next, Bill said, when the pictures change. We're going to make them then. The Silver Balls, Richie said. I thought, it's better this way, Ben said quietly. I still think we could have made the bullets, but thinking isn't good enough. If we were grown-ups... Oh, yeah, the world would be peachy if we were grown-ups, Beverly said. Grown-ups can make anything they want, can't they? Grown-ups can do anything they want, and it always comes out right. She laughed, a jagged, nervous sound. Bill wants me to shoot it. Can you feature that, Eddie? Just call me Beverly Oakley. I don't know what you're talking about, Eddie said, but he thought he did. He was getting some kind of picture anyway. Ben explained. They would melt down one of his silver dollars and make 2 silver balls a little smaller than ball bearings. And then, if there really was a werewolf residing at 29 Niebold Street, Beverly would put a silver ball into its head with Bill's bullseye slingshot. Goodbye, werewolf. And if they were right about one creature who wore many faces, goodbye it.
There must have been some sort of expression on Eddie's face, because Richie laughed and nodded.
I know how you feel, man. I thought Bill must have lost his few remaining marbles when he started talking about using his slingshot instead of his dad's gun.
But this afternoon... He stopped and cleared his throat.
This afternoon after your ma blew us out of the water was how he had been about to start, and that obviously wouldn't do.
This afternoon we went down to the dump. Bill brought his bullseye. Look.
From his back pocket, Richie took a flattened can which had once held Del Monte pineapple chunks.
There was a ragged hole about 2 inches in diameter through the middle of it.
Beverly did that with a rock from 20 feet away.
Looks like a .38 to me.
De Trashmouth was convinced, and when De Trashmouth is convinced, De Trashmouth is convinced.
Killing cans is one thing, Beverly said. If it was something else, something alive...
Bill, you should be the one, really.
No, Bill said. We all took turns. Eustace saw how it went.
How did it go? Eddie asked.
Bill explained, slowly and haltingly, while Beverly looked out the window with her lips pressed so tightly together they were white. She was, for reasons she could not explain even to herself, more than afraid. She was deeply embarrassed by what had happened today. On the way over here tonight, she had argued again, passionately, that they try to make the bullets after all. Not because she was any more sure than Bill or Richie that they would actually work when the time came, but because... If something did happen out at that house, the weapon would be in Bill's, someone else's hands. But facts were facts. They had each taken 10 rocks each and shot the bullseye at 10 cans set up 20 feet away. Richie had gotten 1 out of 10, and his one hit was really only a nick. Ben had gotten 2, Bill 4, Mike 5. Beverly, shooting almost casually and appearing to aim not at all, had banged 9 of the 10 cans dead center. The 10th fell over when the rock she fired bounced off the rim.
But first, we gotta make the ammo.
Night after next? I should be out by then, Eddie said. His mother would protest that, but he didn't think she would protest too much, not after this afternoon.
Does your arm hurt? Beverly asked.
She was wearing a pink dress, not the dress he had seen in his dream. Perhaps she had worn that this afternoon when Ma sent them away. On which she had appliqued small flowers, and silk or nylon hose. She looked very adult, but also somehow very childlike, like a girl playing dress-up. Her expression was dreamy and distant. Eddie thought, I bet that's how she looks when she's sleeping.
Not too much, he said.
They talked for a while, their voices punctuated by thunder. Eddie did not ask them about what had happened when they came to the hospital earlier that day, and none of them mentioned it. Richie took out his yo-yo, made it sleep once or twice, then put it back. Conversation lagged, and in one of the pauses there was a brief click that made Eddie look around. Bill had something in his hand, and for a moment Eddie felt his heart speed up in alarm. For that brief moment he thought it was a knife. But then Stan turned on the rooms overhead, dispelling the gloom, and he saw it was only a ballpoint pen. In the light they all looked natural again, real, only his friends.
I thought we ought to sign your cast, Bill said.
His eyes met Eddie squarely.
But that's not it, Eddie thought with sudden and alarming clarity. It's a contract. It's a contract, Big Bill, isn't it? Or the closest we'll ever get to one.
He was frightened, and then ashamed and angry at himself. If he had broken his arm before this summer, who would have signed the cast? Anyone besides his mother and perhaps Dr. Handor? His aunts in Haven?
These were his friends.
And his mother was wrong. They weren't bad friends.
Maybe, he thought, there aren't any such things as good friends or bad friends. Maybe there are just friends. People who stand by you when you're hurt and who help you feel not so lonely. Maybe they're always worth being scared for and hoping for and living for. Maybe worth dying for, too, if that's what has to be. No good friends, no bad friends. Only people you want, need to be with, people who build their houses in your heart.
Okay, Eddie said a little hoarsely.
Okay. That'd be real good, Big Bill.
So Bill leaned solemnly over his bed and wrote his name on the hillocky plaster of Paris that encased Eddie's mending arm, the letters large and looping. Richie signed with a flourish. Ben's handwriting was as narrow as he was wide, the letters slanting backward. They looked ready to fall over at the slightest push. Mike Hanlon's writing was large and awkward because he was left-handed and the angle was bad for him. He signed above Eddie's elbow and circled his name. When Beverly bent over him, He could smell some light flowery perfume on her. She signed in a round Palmer Method script. Stan came last, and he wrote his name in tight-packed little letters by Eddie's wrist. They all stepped back then, as if aware of what they had done. Outside, thunder muttered heavily again. Lightning washed the hospital's wooden exterior in brief, stuttering light.
"That's it?" Eddie asked.
Bill nodded.
"Come over to my house after supper, day after tomorrow, if you can, okay?"
Eddie nodded, and the subject was closed. There was another period of desultory, almost aimless conversation. Some of it was about the dominant topic in Derry that July, the trial of Richard Macklin for the bludgeon murder of his stepson, Dorsey, and the disappearance of Dorsey's older brother, Eddie Corcoran. Macklin would not break down and confess, weeping on the witness stand for another 2 days, but the losers were in agreement that Macklin probably had nothing to do with Eddie's disappearance. The boy had either run away, or it had gotten him. They left around 7:15, and the rain still had not fallen. It continued to threaten until long after Eddie's ma had come, made her visit, and gone home again. She had been horrified at the signatures on Eddie's cast, and even more horrified at his determination to leave the hospital the following day. She had been envisioning a stay of a week or more in absolute quiet, so that the ends of the break could set together, as she said. Eventually, the storm clouds broke apart and drifted away. Not so much as a drop of rain had fallen in Derry. The humidity remained, and people slept on porches and on lawns and in sleeping bags in back fields that night. The rain came the next day, not long after Beverly saw something terrible happen to Patrick Hockstetter. Chapter 17. Another one of the missing. The death of Patrick Hockstetter. 1.
When he finishes, Eddie pours himself another drink with a hand not completely steady. He looks at Beverly and says, "You saw it, didn't you? You saw it take Patrick Hockstetter the day after you all signed my cast."
The others lean forward. Beverly pushes her hair back in a reddish cloud. Beneath it, her face looks extraordinarily pale. She fumbles a fresh cigarette out of her pack, the last one, and flicks her Bic. She can't seem to guide the flame to the tip of her cigarette. After a moment, Bill holds her wrist lightly but firmly and puts the flame where it's supposed to go. Beverly looks at him gratefully and exhales a cloud of bluish-gray smoke.
"Yeah," she says, "I saw that happen."
She shivers.
"He was crazy," Bill says, and thinks.
Just the fact that Henry let a flaco like Patrick Hockstetter hang around as that summer wore on, that says something, doesn't it? Either that Henry was losing some of his charm, some of his attraction, or that Henry's own craziness had progressed far enough so that the Hockstetter kid seemed okay to him. Both came to the same thing. Henry's increasing, what, degeneration? Is that the word? Yes, in light of what happened to him, where he ended up, I think it is. There's something else to support the idea, too, Bill thinks. But as yet he can only remember it vaguely. He and Richie and Beverly had been down at Tracker Brothers, early August by then, and the summer school that had kept Henry out of their hair for most of the summer was just about to end, and hadn't Victor Chris approached them? A very frightened Victor Chris?
Yes, that had happened. Things had been rapidly approaching the end by then, and Bill thinks now that every kid in Derry had sensed it, the losers and Henry's group most of all. But that had been later.
"Oh, yeah, you got that right," Beverly says flatly. "Patrick Hockstetter was crazy. None of the girls would sit in front of him in school. You'd be sitting there doing your arithmetic or writing a story or a composition, and all at once you'd feel this hand, almost as light as a feather, but warm and sweaty. Meaty." She swallows, and there is a small click in her throat. The others watch her solemnly from around the table. "You'd feel it on your side, or maybe on your breast. Not that any of us had much in the way of breasts back then, but Patrick didn't seem to care about that. You'd feel that touch, and you'd jerk away from it and turn around, and there Patrick would be, grinning with those big rubbery lips. He had a pencil box full of flies," Richie says suddenly. "Sure, he'd kill 'em with this green ruler he had, and then put 'em in his pencil box. I even remember what it looked like, red with a wavy white plastic cover that slid open and closed." Eddie is nodding. "You'd jerk away and he'd grin and then maybe he'd open his pencil box so you could see the dead flies inside," Beverly says. "And the worst thing, the horrible thing, was the way he'd smile and never say anything. Mrs. Douglas knew, Greta Bowie told on him, and I think Sally Mueller said something once, too. But I think Mrs. Douglas was scared of him, too.
Ben has rocked back on the rear legs of his chair, and his hands are laced behind his neck. She still cannot believe how lean he is.
I'm pretty sure you're right, he says. Well, what happened to him, Beverly? Bill asks.
She swallows again, trying to fight off the nightmarish power of what she saw that day in the Barrens, her roller skates tied together and hung over her shoulder, one knee a stinging net of pain from a fall she had taken on St. Crispin's Lane, and other of the short tree-lined streets that dead-ended where the land fell, and still falls, sharply into the Barrens. She remembers, oh, these memories, when they come, are so clear and so powerful, that she was wearing a pair of denim shorts, really too short. They came only to just below the hem of her panties. She had become more conscious of her body over the last year, over the last 6 months, actually, as it began to curve and become more womanly. The mirror was one reason for this heightened consciousness, of course, but not the main one. The main one was that her father seemed even sharper just lately, more apt to use his slapping hand or even his fists. He seemed restless, almost caged, and she was more and more nervous when she was around him, more and more on her mark. It was as if there was a smell they made between them, a smell that wasn't there when she was in the apartment alone, one that had never been there when they were in it together. Not until this summer. And when Mom was gone, it was worse. If there was a smell, some smell, then he knew it too, maybe, because Bev saw less and less of him as the hot weather wore on, partly because of his summer bowling league, partly because he was helping his friend Joe Tamerly fix cars. But she suspects it was partly that smell, the one they made between them, neither of them meaning to, but making it just the same, as helpless to stop it as either was helpless to stop sweating in July. The vision of the birds, hundreds and thousands of them, descending on the roof peaks of houses, on telephone wires, on TV aerials, intervenes again.
And poison ivy, she says aloud.
Well, what? Bill asks.
Something about poison ivy, she says slowly, looking at him. But it wasn't. It just felt like poison ivy. Mike?
Never mind, Mike says. It will come. Tell us what you do remember, Bev.
I remember the blue shorts, she would tell them, and how faded they were getting, how tight around my hips and butt. I had half a pack of Lucky Strikes in one pocket and the bullseye in the other.
Do you remember the bullseye? She asks Richie.
But they all nod.
Bill gave it to me, she says. I didn't want it, but
She smiles at Bill, a little wanly.
You couldn't say no to Big Bill, that was all. So I had it, and that's why I was out by myself that day, to practice. I still didn't think I'd have the guts to use it when the time came. Except, I used it that day. I had to. I killed one of them. One of the parts of it. It was terrible. Even now it's hard for me to think of. And one of the others got me. Look.
She raises her arm and turns it over so they can all see a puckery scar on the roundest part of her upper forearm. It looks as if a hot circular object about the size of a Havana cigar had been pressed against her skin. It is slightly sunken, and looking at it gives Mike Hanlon a chill. This is one of the parts of the story which, like Eddie's unwilling heart-to-heart with Keane, he has suspected but never actually heard.
You were right about one thing, Richie, she says. That bullseye was a killer. I was scared of it, but I sort of loved it, too.
Richie laughs and claps her on the back.
Shit, I knew that back then, you stupid skirt.
You did, really?
Yeah, really, he says. It was something in your eyes, Bevy.
I mean, it looked like a toy, but it was real. You could blow holes in things.
And you blew a hole in something with it that day, Ben muses. She nods. Was it Patrick, you?
No, God, no, Beverly says. It was the other. Wait.
She crushes out her cigarette, sips her drink, and gets herself under control again. Finally, she is.
Well, no.
But she has a feeling it's the closest she's going to get tonight.
I was roller skating, you see, and I fell down and gave myself a good scrape. Then I decided I'd go down to the Barrens and practice. I went by the clubhouse first to see if you guys were there. You weren't. Just that smoky smell. You guys remember how long that place went on smelling of smoke?
They all nod, smiling.
We never really did get the smell out, did we? Ben says. So then I headed down to the dump, she says, because that's where we had the tryouts, I guess you'd call them, and I knew there'd be lots of things to shoot at. Maybe even, you know, rats. She pauses. There's a fine misty sweat on her forehead now. That's what I really wanted to shoot at, she says finally. Something that was alive, not a seagull. I knew I couldn't shoot a gull, but a rat. I wanted to see if I could. I'm glad I came from the Kansas Street side instead of the old Cape side, though, because there wasn't much cover over there by the railroad embankment. They would have seen me, and God knows what would have happened then.
Who would have seen you?
Them, Beverly says. Henry Bowers, Victor Crisp, Belch Huggins, and Patrick Hockstetter. They were down in the dump, and... Suddenly, amazing all of them, she begins to giggle like a child, her cheeks turning rose red. She giggles until tears stand in her eyes. What the hell, Bev? Richie says. Let us in on the joke.
Oh, it was a joke, all right, she says. It was a joke, but I think they might have killed me if they knew I'd seen.
I remember now, Ben cries, and he begins to laugh, too.
I remember you telling us.
Giggling wildly, Beverly says,
they had their pants down and they were lighting farts.
There is an instant of thunderstruck silence, and then they all begin to laugh. The sound echoes through the library. Thinking of exactly how to tell them of Patrick Hockstetter's death, the thing she fixes on first is how approaching the town dump from the Kansas Street side was like entering some weird asteroid belt. There was a rutted dirt track, a town road, actually. It even had a name, Old Lime Street, that ran from Kansas Street to the dump, the only actual road into the Barrens. The city's dump trucks used it. Beverly walked near Old Lime Street, but didn't take it. She had grown more cautious. She supposed all of them had, since Eddie's arm had been broken, especially when she was alone. She wove her way through the heavy undergrowth, skirting a patch of poison ivy with its reddish, oily leaves, smelling the dump's smoky rot, hearing the seagulls. On her left, through occasional breaks in the foliage, she could see Old Lime Street. The others are looking at her, waiting. She checks her cigarette pack and finds it empty. Wordlessly, Richie tosses her one of his. She lights up, looks around at them, and says, heading toward the dump from the Kansas Street side was a little like... two. Entering some weird asteroid belt. The dumpoid belt. At first there was nothing but the underbrush growing from the spongy ground underfoot, and then you would see your first dumpoid. A rusty can that had once contained Prince spaghetti sauce, maybe, or a Soke soda bottle crawling with bugs attracted by the sweet, sticky remains of cream soda or birch beer. Then there would be a bright wink of sun kicking off a scrap of tinfoil caught in a tree. You might see a bed spring, or trip over it if you weren't watching where you were going, or a bone some dog had carried away, gnawed, dropped. The dump itself wasn't so bad, was in fact sort of interesting, Beverly thought. What was nasty, and sort of creepy, was the way it had of spreading, of creating this dumpoid belt. She was getting closer now. The trees were bigger, mostly firs, and the bushes were thinning out. The gulls cheeped and cried in their shrill, querulous voices, and the air was smudgy with the smell of burning. Now, on Beverly's right, leaning at an angle against the base of a spruce tree, was a rusty Amana refrigerator. Beverly glanced at it, thinking vaguely of the state policeman who had visited her class when she had been in the third grade. He had told them that such things as discarded refrigerators were dangerous. A kid could climb into one while playing hide-and-go-seek, for instance, and smother to death inside. Although why anyone would want to get in a scroungy old... She heard a shout, so close it made her jump, followed by laughter. Beverly grinned. So they were here. They had left the clubhouse because of the smoky smell and had come down here. They were maybe breaking bottles with rocks, maybe just dump picking. She began to walk a little faster, the nasty scrape she had gotten earlier now forgotten in her eagerness to see them. To see him, with his red hair so much like hers. To see if he would smile at her in that oddly endearing, one-sided way of his. She knew she was too young to love a boy, too young to have anything but crushes, but she loved Bill just the same. And she walked a little faster, her skate swinging heavily from her shoulder, the sling of his bullseye beating soft time against her left buttock. She almost walked into them before realizing it wasn't her gang at all, but Bowers's. She walked out of the screening bushes, and the dump's steepest side lay about 70 yards ahead, a twinkling avalanche of junk lying along the high angle of the gravel pit. Mandy Fazio's bulldozer was off to the left. Much closer in front of her was a wilderness of junked cars. At the end of each month, these were crushed and hauled off to Portland for scrap, but now there were a dozen or more, some sitting on bare wheel rims, some on their sides, one or two lying on their roofs like dead dogs. They were arranged in two rows, and Beverly walked down the rough, trash-littered aisle between them like some punk bride of the future, wondering idly if she could break a windshield with the bullseye. One of the pockets of her blue shorts bulged with the small ball bearings that were her practice ammo. The voices and laughter were coming from beyond the junked-out cars and to the left, at the edge of the dump proper. Beverly rounded the last one, a Studebaker, with its entire front end missing. Her hail of greeting died on her lips. The hand she had put up to wave did not exactly fall back to her side. It seemed to wilt. Her first furiously embarrassed thought was, "Oh, dear God, why are they all naked?" This was followed by the scary realization of who they were. She froze there in front of the half-Studebaker with her shadow stapled to the heels of her low-topped sneakers. For that one moment, she was totally visible to them. If any of the four had looked up from the circle they were squatting in, he could not have missed her, a girl of slightly more than medium height, a pair of skates over one shoulder, the knee of one long coltish leg still oozing blood, her mouth slack-jawed, her cheeks scarlet. Before darting back behind the Studebaker, she saw that they weren't entirely naked after all. They had their shirts on, and their pants and underpants were simply pulled down to their shoe tops, as if they had to go number two. In her shock, Beverly's mind had automatically reverted to the euphemism she had been taught as a toddler. Except who ever heard of four boys going number two at the same time? Once out of sight again, her first thought was to get away fast. Her heart was pumping hard, her muscles heavy with adrenaline. She looked around, seeing what she hadn't bothered to notice walking up here when she thought the voices she heard belonged to her friends. The row of junked cars on her left was really pretty thin. They were by no means packed in door to door as they would be in the week or so before the crusher came to turn them into rough blocks of twinkling metal. She had been exposed to the boys several times walking up to where she was now. If she retreated, she would be exposed again, and this time she might be seen. Also, she felt a certain shameful curiosity. What in the world could they be doing? Carefully, she peeked around the Studebaker. Henry and Victor Chris were more or less facing in her direction. Patrick Hockstetter was on Henry's left. Belch Huggins had his back to her. She observed the fact that Belch had an extremely large, extremely hairy ass, and half-hysterical giggles suddenly bubbled up her throat like the head on a glass of ginger ale. She had to clap both hands over her mouth and withdraw behind the Studebaker again, struggling to hold the giggles in. "You've got to get out of here, Beverly. If they catch you..." She looked back down between the junked cars, still holding her hands over her mouth. The aisle was maybe 10 feet wide, littered with cans, twinkling with little jigsaw pieces of safety glass, scruffy with weeds. If she so much as made a sound, they might hear her, particularly if their absorption in whatever strange thing they were doing flagged. When she thought of how casually she had walked up here, her blood ran cold. Also, what in the world can they be doing? She peeked again, seeing more of the details this time. There was a careless scatter of books and papers nearby, school books. They had just come from their summer classes then, what most of the kids called dummy school or makeup school. And because Henry and Victor were facing her way, she could see their things. They were the first things she had ever seen in her life, other than pictures in a smudgy little book that Brenda Arrowsmith had showed her the year before, and in those pictures you really couldn't see very much. Bev observed now that their things were little tubes that hung down between their legs. Henry's was small and hairless, but Victor's was quite big, and there was a cloudy fuzz of fine black hair just over it. "Bill has one of those," she thought, and suddenly her whole body seemed to flush at once. Heat rushed through her in a wave that made her feel giddy and faint and almost sick to her stomach. In that moment she felt much the way Ben Hanscom had felt on the last day of school, looking down at her ankle bracelet and observing the way it flashed in the sun. But he had not felt the intermixed sense of terror she felt now. She looked behind her once more. Now the pathway between the cars leading to the shelter of the barrens seemed much longer. She was scared to move. If they knew she had seen their things, they would probably hurt her, and not just a little. They would hurt her badly. Belch Huggins bellowed suddenly, making her jump, and Henry yelled, "3 feet! No shit, Belch! It was 3 feet! Wasn't it, Vic?" Vic agreed it was, and they all roared with troll-like laughter. Beverly tried another look around the junk Studebaker. Patrick Hockstetter had turned and half-risen so that his butt was nearly in Henry's face. In Henry's hand was a silvery, glinting object. After a moment's study, she made it out as a lighter.
"I thought you said you felt one coming on," Henry said.
"I do," Patrick said. "I'll tell you when. Get ready. Get ready. It's coming. Get... now!" Henry flicked the lighter. At the same moment, there was the unmistakable ripping sound of a really good fart. There was no mistaking that sound. Beverly had heard it enough in her own house, usually on Saturday night after the beans and Frank's. A regular bear for his beans was her father. As Patrick blew off and Henry flicked the lighter, she saw something that made her jaw drop. A bright blue jet of flame appeared to roar directly out of Patrick's bum. To Bev, it looked like the pilot light on a gas burner. The boys roared their troll-like laughter, and Beverly withdrew behind the sheltering car, stifling mad giggles again. She was laughing, but not because she was amused. In some very weird way, it was funny, yes, but mostly she was laughing because she felt a deep revulsion accompanied by a sort of horror. She was laughing because she knew of no other way to cope with what she had seen. It had something to do with seeing the boys' things, but that was by no means all or even the great part of what she felt. She had known, after all, that boys had things, the same way she knew that girls had different things. This was only what you might call a confirmed sighting. But the rest of what they were doing seemed so strange, so ludicrous, and yet at the same time so deadly primitive, that she found herself, in spite of the giggling fit, groping for the core of herself with some desperation. "Stop," she thought, as if this were the answer. "Stop, they'll hear you. So just you stop it, Bevy." But that was impossible. The best she could do was to laugh without engaging her vocal cords, so that the sounds came out of her in a series of almost inaudible chuffs. Her hands pasted over her mouth, her cheeks as red as Mac apples, her eyes swimming with tears.
"Holy shit, that hurts," Victor roared.
12 feet, Henry bellowed. "I swear to God, Vic, 12 fucking feet. I swear to my mother's name.
I don't care if it was 20 fucking feet. You burned my ass off."
Victor howled, and there was more bellowing laughter. Still trying to giggle silently from behind the sheltering car, Beverly thought of a movie she had seen on TV. John Hall had been in it. It was about this jungle tribe. They had a secret rite, and if you saw it, you got sacrificed to their god, which was this big stone idol. This did not stop her giggles, but infused them with a nearly frantic quality. They were becoming more and more like silent screams. Her belly hurt. Tears streamed down her face. 3. Henry Victor Belch and Patrick Hockstetter ended up in the dump lighting each other's farts on that hot July afternoon because of Rena Davenport. Henry knew what resulted from consuming large amounts of baked beans. This result was perhaps best expressed in a little ditty he had learned at his father's knee when he was still in short pants. "Beans, beans, the musical fruit, the more you eat, the more you toot. The more you toot, the better you feel, then you're ready for another meal." Rena Davenport and his father had been courting for nearly 8 years. She was fat, 40, and usually filthy. Henry supposed that Rena and his father sometimes fucked, although he could not imagine anyone squashing his body down on Rena Davenport's. Rena's beans were her pride. She soaked them Saturday nights and baked them over a slow fire all day Sunday. Henry supposed they were okay. They were something to shovel into your mouth and chew up anyway. But after 8 years, anything lost its charm. Nor was Rena content to make just a few beans. She cooked them in job lots. When she turned up Sunday evenings in her old green DeSoto, a naked rubber baby doll hung from the rearview mirror, looking like the world's youngest lynch mob victim, she usually had the Bowers' beans steaming on the seat beside her in a 12-gallon galvanized steel pail. The three of them would eat the beans that night, Rena raving about her own cooking all the while, crazy Butch Bowers grunting and mopping up bean juice with a piece of Sonny Boy bread, or simply telling her to shut up if there was a ball game on the radio. Henry just eating, staring out the window, thinking his own thoughts. It was over a plate of Sunday night beans that he had conceived the idea of poisoning Mike Hanlon's dog, Mr. Chips. And Butch would reheat a mess of them the next night. On Tuesdays and Wednesdays, Henry would take a Tupperware box full of them to school. By Thursday or Friday, neither Henry nor his father could eat any more. The house's 2 bedrooms would smell of stale farts in spite of the open windows.
Butch would take the remains and mix them into the other slops and feed them to Bip and Bop, the Bowers' two pigs. Rena would like as not show up the following Sunday with another steaming pail, and the cycle would start all over again. That morning, Henry had put up an enormous quantity of leftover beans, and the four of them had eaten the whole lot at noon, sitting out on the playground in the shade of a big old elm. They had eaten until they were nearly bursting. It had been Patrick who suggested they go down to the dump, which would be fairly quiet in the middle of a working day summer afternoon. By the time they arrived, the beans were doing their work quite nicely.